you're asking people to put investment rands or dollars into your business when they have the choice of buying Apple or Microsoft or Amazon or kind of Alibaba or you name it. And then you realize that that's who you're competing with at those kind of numbers. So your story about tomorrow has to be compelling. I realize that there's a trade-off between enterprise value and utility value. And that trade-off often is made by business owners without appreciating that they're making the trade-off. So every time you make a call as a business owner to extract value from the business, you are in some way reducing the equity value of your business.
Before we start this podcast, I've got one little favor to ask you. Can you please hit the subscribe button down below so we can help more people every single week? Thank you.
Welcome to the Right Place podcast. And we're very fortunate to have Keith Fairhurst with us today from Scale Up Partners. Last year, I attended the Scale Up conference, and what struck me was from a very small-ish crowd, I actually got to know two people very well, and I've done business with one out of that conference last year. So this year, we decided to take part again, and we decided to have a bit of a discussion with Keith in advance to hear what they're going to do and what it's all about and to tell the world a bit about it. So before we jump into all of that, Keith, welcome and thank you for joining us.
It's nice to be here, Rudolph. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, good. So, Keith, you are obviously a director at Scale Up Partners, and I would want to hear a little bit about that and what you guys do there later on. But you're also involved in Gibbs at the business school. And I think that's how you got into this this part of the discussion of getting Gibbs to join your Scale Up Partners as well. What is your role within those two businesses?
So Rudolph, I guess I have one foot in business and one foot in academia. I'm very drawn to the science of what we do and the research behind business. So over the years, I've found myself continually being involved in some way or another with learning. And as a consequence, after I did two master's degrees, I did my PhD at Tookie's. Oh. And of course, Gibbs is a Tookie's business school. And I've been a professional associate there for about 12 years. So I'm not employed by the business school, but I have academic privileges. And that I can do research and I can use the access to journals, etc. But most importantly, I work with students who are doing master's degrees predominantly, and I work on executive leadership programs. I really find it's quite privileged. And in fact, just last night, I was working with the first-year MBA students, and I came away from it really, really uplifted because it's such a privilege to see people put themselves out there, take big risks, work very, very hard, and grow in ways that they never imagined they would, and show up in the world as real change makers. So I guess that's, in a nutshell, what I do. Gibbs is incredibly progressive in their thinking in respect of business education. They're probably one of the pioneering business schools in the world that has a part of the faculty called PAL, which is Professional and Applied Learning, which is where I am located, I suppose, if you look at a group of people at the school. And that's taking the academic knowledge and applying it in the real world. Sure. And one of our brand promises at Scale Up Partners is that we are informed by science. So we say practice informed by science. In that context, Gibbs has been engaging with us for some time about taking the work we do and sharing it with a bigger audience. And so we're delighted that Gibbs has partnered with us on our first event and the anticipation of a multi-year partnership aimed at what I call the missing middle, which is the privately owned businesses that are beyond the startup phase, but are not yet incredibly well known and incredibly large or listed on a stock exchange. And these businesses are really the foundation of much of our economy. They employ more than 60% of the people employed in the country. They have a huge impact on the economy, and it's an economic space that is under-researched, not well understood, and there's not a lot. We've not seen a lot of active programs aimed at supporting privately owned businesses that are trying hard to do the right thing, make a difference in the economy, and grow. Oh, I said a mouthful now. I hope it kind of landed well. So I'm going to pause for a minute and let you just unpick what I've said and see whether
100%.
You want to elaborate on anything.
Yeah, good. I want to quickly climb out with this last part. I saw an article actually in this week or maybe over the weekend saying that South Africa is probably on that scale the most difficult place in the world to do business in. And I looked at it and I thought to myself, it can't be, because we're obviously here. We're busy. We probably used to how things work. And for that reason, we just grind it out and we continue. But if I look at how many people leave the country and very skilled people, I realize that there must be something that, apart from crime, there must be something else as well that triggers those movements. But what's your take on that? Because the larger corporates dominate the market. But as you said now, 60% of the workforce sits in this missing middle part. And to get companies there to that middle part where more employment is generated, more of the economy happens. And what's your take on this environment in South Africa where it's actually difficult to start up and to grow to that phase?
You know, Rudolf, I suppose I can only talk about it through my lens, through kind of my as lived experience in some ways, and of course, research that I'm exposed to. But it goes way back to the 90s when I was a lot younger. I was 29. I started my first business, which I ran for 6 years and then sold. I grew it notably in the Western Cape, and I sold it. I didn't sell it for enough to retire or enough to, to rest on my laurels. But I did realize enough return to be able to go and do an MBA, not full time, but semi full time. And I did a bit of consulting while I was doing my MBA. And it was during that period that I was exposed to a different kind of set of thinking, which helped me articulate some of the things I'd experienced as a young business owner. And I use the word entrepreneur cautiously because I think the word has got many meanings to different people. And I don't really feel it's useful to unpack that. So I prefer to think of it in the context of people who own their business and are business owners. And that's what I was. And I realized that it's a very alone place. And I choose my word carefully because sometimes it's not lonely, but you are alone. And you're alone in your challenges and you're alone in your successes often. And I wrote a paper, which I called The Aloneness of the Entrepreneur, which got me thinking about it. And way back then, I started to explore how privately owned smaller businesses were supported. And I found that there was little distinction between privately owned businesses and large businesses. In fact, I interviewed a number of banks. And when I spoke to people, I said, well, how do you measure them and look at them? And they said, well, the same way as we look at all businesses. And that to me was a sign that there is little distinction made. I mean, we can go and look at material and we will see that a gross profit percentage is a gross profit percentage. It doesn't matter whether you're a five-man business or a 5,000-person business. But there are different dynamics. And, who run a business as a founder, as I've done more than once in my life. And I kind of realized that until you've had to work out how to have enough money in the bank to pay wages on Friday, and if you haven't got that money in the bank, you can't pay wages or salaries, you may not have a true deep understanding of what it means to be a privately owned business. And over the years, I've wrestled with this, and it's probably only in the last 10 years that it started to take shape for me, which has resulted in us doing Scale Up Partners. Now, again, I've probably gone off at a bit of a tangent. You're asking me what's my take on it. Starting and growing a business is difficult anywhere. Yeah. I think in South Africa, it is particularly difficult because we don't have to go very far to see the challenges. You only have to look at the news each day and look at how things are overregulated. You have to jump through dozens of hoops to do business, to trade with large corporations and to trade with parastatals and to trade with government. And I really, this is not, I don't want to go down the road that everybody bashes, which is, you know, the challenges of BEE and other things like that. But the simple act of trying to register a business or register for VAT just takes a long time. And it's difficult. Much of it is necessary, I appreciate, but it really is not easy at all. I also think that South Africa as an economy may not have a full appreciation of the impact privately owned companies have in terms of the economy. You know, I've spent time in the USA, I've spent time in Europe, I've spent time in the UK and in the Gulf states. And in many ways, privately owned businesses and even like mom and pop shops are celebrated and supported in ways. And I don't mean with capital. Capital is one thing, but capital is only one thing. There are many, many other mechanisms to support them just by making it easy for them to do business, giving them access to markets and supporting the thinking of privately owned companies. So without sort of digressing into, you know, the socioeconomic challenges that South Africa has, I think it is a difficult place to do business in general. Visitors from foreign countries that I've met and know have said how much easier it is to do business elsewhere, you know, and it's hard enough anywhere. I think it's made particularly difficult here. Yeah, I guess that's probably kind of in a nutshell. I want to comment on one thing, and I mean, if this is inappropriate for your audience, you can tell me. But I was at a conference last week, and I'm going to leave names out of it, but a very well-known founder of a very large and successful and innovative business in South Africa did a presentation where he presented data and spoke about defending the middle. And he's talking about this middle batch of participants in our economy and our country. And that resonated so strongly with me because I've been talking to my colleagues and fellow academics as well about this missing middle, being this middle group of businesses in South Africa that truly can make a difference in our economy. I believe firmly in that. Whenever I deal with these kinds of businesses, I get so excited. Last Friday, I was at one of my clients' annual financial year kickoff events. I was so proud of them because, first of all, they grew their revenue profitably by 35% in 1 year. And that it was a big chunky piece of growth. So 35% growth brings challenges. It brings pressure because they didn't borrow to grow that. They funded it from cash flow, which anybody who's grown a business knows is painful, especially at that level of growth. But I was so proud because their executive team, when they did their presentations, they said things like, my critical number for the next quarter is, and that is what the kind of thinking we hope to engender. And we see when you go to places like the United States or Israel or Singapore, who are well known for, they work on the business as well as working in the business. And I got so proud when I heard four executive managers talking about their critical number for the next quarter, which was numerical translation of their plan, which a year earlier I'd not heard. So I get super excited, as you may gather, when I hear language like that.
Yeah, it's very cool. I think the to make it practical for other people is important. And I think in a room where you kick off a financial year, there's a lot of numbers people. So the number would also resonate with the crowd, and people can hold you accountable to that. And that actually is a big driver. If you know that there is an expectation of reaching a specific predetermined number, there's a big driver in that. I want to jump into scale up choice. So I met Jordan by chance last year, June, through a mutual friend. And he asked me if I want to be a sponsor at Scale Up Choice last year. there at Menland, Maine. And I said, yes, I thought I couldn't, for the price he asked me, I couldn't say no, but also that there's going to be a lot of new people that I don't have access to. And I thought, let me do that. And I was pleasantly surprised. And I think I saw you talking there. It was quite a long session, I think 2 or 3 hours with a little bit of a break in the middle. But what is Scale Up Choice? What is the essence of what you want to achieve at this little bit of a workshop? I don't want to call it a conference, but a workshop where you're going to talk about this missing middle. And specifically, I think the theme is about if you're working almost for a lifestyle or working to build wealth and build something of something. So what is Scale Up Choice, what it's about, and what do you want to achieve through that?
Rudolf, again, let me go a little bit back in my personal history. I think where the thinking for this started was probably about 12 or 15 years ago, when a friend of mine and business associate, done business with him, who owns his own business, approached me the one day and he said to me, Keith, won't you help us with our strategy? So I started doing some strategy development work with them, which was kind of interesting. And the one day he was very frustrated because he was wanting to raise some capital for an exciting project he had in mind. And the project had merit and was interesting. And he said, but Keith, nobody's prepared to back me or provide any funding. And I'm sort of not really getting, people are not returning my calls type thing. So I said, well, let's have a look at it and work through it. And then I said, well, show me your balance sheet. And he showed me his balance sheet. And I said, well, here's your answer. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, your balance sheet is pretty empty, you know? And he said, well, how can that be? I mean, we've spent 15 years building this business. Look how well we've done. And it really then was a stark kind of illustration of the trade-off for a lifestyle business. So their business was successful. It had traded for more than 15 years very successfully, and they had done very well and made good profits. What they'd done, though, as a family, is they'd taken the profits out of the business and they'd used it to build their own personal asset base, which is not wrong. Like I've said to people, that's not the wrong thing to do. There's nothing. That's your call. It's your business. But be mindful of the trade-off you make, because if you're hoping to either raise capital or sell your business or list your business in the future, it's going to depend on what's in your business. And that's typically starts in your balance sheet, with an asset base and retained income. And if you've over 15 years maximized your personal assets out, you know, so you've extracted from the company and you've, you know, put it into your personal family's thing, then you're probably not going to realize the value that you think your business is worth. Excuse me. With that as a thought back 15 years ago, it's never left me. And a few years ago, I started talking about the trade of choice. And in economic terms, if you study economics, and those that have will recognize the term utility value. You know, there's an economic term, utility value. That's the use I get from something. And I realized that there's a trade off between enterprise value and utility value. And that trade off often is made by business owners without appreciating that they're making the trade-off. So every time you make a call as a business owner to extract value from the business, you are in some way reducing the equity value of your business, your enterprise value, and translated into equity value. And that's fine, because if you're the business owner, that's why you may be in business. And what I hope to do is to make that a very conscious and intentional choice of business owners. So the Scale Up Choice came about as a consequence, of a journal article that I wrote for the Gibbs Business Magazine called Acumen, where I kind of tried to express this thinking in an article, and it was published in the journal. And your Don, who I'm proud to say was a high-performing MBA student at Gibbs that I worked with in 2022, he read the article and he shared it with friends and family who own their own business. And he came back to me. He said, you know, Keith, people are saying, we've never thought of this. Can we have a coffee or a breakfast or a lunch or something just to talk it through with you and Keith? And I said, of course. I mean, you know, I love talking about this stuff. This stuff is like, gives it lights up my day. So I said, with pleasure, tell me when we're going to have coffee. And then somebody else challenged him, one of his friends, to do something that made him afraid. And that resulted in him with a few other people saying, well, let's put on a seminar. And so the Scale Up Choice seminar was born in Pretoria at a venue called Colab. And he said to me, am I prepared to come and talk? And I said, with pleasure. And that's what we did. And so I guess the stars aligned a little bit for us, Rudolph, in that we kind of handed it over, you know, without being too kind of esoteric about it. I kind of said, well, you know, really all I can do is share what I know and what I've seen. And that's what I tried to do. And we had 75 people attend or 70 people attend, which was an amazing response. So that told us that there's a real need and a real hunger out there to understand this kind of thinking. And that's where the next evolution of Scale Up Partners was born. And over the last year, Don and myself with another colleague, Colleen, and my son, Jason, who built our platform for delivering online, have like said, okay, so how do we scale up to use a phrase we use internally. And, We're kicking it off with a repeat of the Scale Up Choice at Gibbs. We are so excited that Gibbs see the value in reaching this missing middle. And we appreciate the professionalism, the insight, and their knowledge that they bring to our equation. And so that's how it kind of got born. And there's a few parts to it. So the first part is the kickoff event, which is the Scale Up Choice, where we're going to talk a little bit about making this trade-off intentional so that business owners, whether you run a construction company, an IT business, a services company, a manufacturing business, you think twice and say, okay, if I'm going to extract this value from the business, whether it's in the form of dividends, profit sharing, paying for a utility, a new vehicle, like for instance, you might say, well, I've earned it. You know, I want to buy myself a new Land Cruiser. That's cool. Enjoy it. But there is a trade-off and just be aware of that trade-off. So I want to capture it in a little bit of science that resonated with me. So there's an author called Morgan Housel who wrote a book called The Psychology of Money. He says in one of his books, in another book, he says, any organization's value is a number of today multiplied by a story of tomorrow. Now, you can pick a number of today. The number we choose to use is a number described as EBITDA because it's the most widely used number for valuations, probably globally. It's not the only one, but it is one that a lot of people are familiar with. And then there's a multiplier. So people talk about the multiplier. Where I've engaged with business owners who have been running their business for 15 or 20 years, I often ask them the question. I say, well, what is your business worth? And they say, no, I wouldn't sell it for less than, I'm just going to pick a number randomly, 100 million. I say, okay, what is your EBITDA? And when they stop looking at me with a confused look, we kind of unpack what EBITDA is because many people don't appreciate it. Yeah. When they do unpack it, and then we kind of get into a conversation of what it might look like to a potential investor or a provider of capital. And the example I normally use is Apple. So Apple has been trading, I don't know what the latest figures are, but there's a term when you look at listed companies called your PE ratio, your price earnings ratio, which is the annual earnings as a ratio of your share price. And in Apple's case, Apple has been trading at between 25 and 35 for the last 10 or 15 years. So let's call it 30. It's probably high. It's probably 32 or 34 or something like that. That is the multiplier. So now when somebody says their business is worth 200 million or 100 million, and you go and do the EBITDA number and you find the EBITDA is 5, that's a 20-to-1. Or now when you're looking at, and often when I've done that calculation, the business owner, the number is higher, but you're asking people to put investment rands or dollars into your business when they have the choice of buying Apple or Microsoft or Amazon or kind of Alibaba or you name it. And then you realize that that's who you're competing with at those kind of numbers. So your story about tomorrow has to be compelling. We've unpacked the story about tomorrow into two big functions. It's the function of leadership, because no company can outperform the consciousness of their leaders. Just think about that for a moment. If a leader is here, they can pull the business up to there. But if the leader's here, they're probably going to pull the business down to their level. So leaders have an obligation to keep on developing themselves if they want their business to develop. So one of the functions of the story of tomorrow is leadership, and the other one is governance. And we unpack those two. Leadership is vision, talent, and strategy, and governance is performance management and control. And that, we believe, those factors play a huge influence on the multiplier you will get. So if you have this vision of selling your business in some day or listing it, then it's a good idea to work on the story of tomorrow. And that's what we hope to help people unpack a little bit more clearly for themselves and to make more intentional choices about their future. So again, I've said a lot. Let me stop and let you kind of pick it apart.
Yeah, very good. I quite enjoy that. And I think, as you said, there's a number of components in what you've answered. But what stuck out for me is that there's this conscious decision almost. And in the past, it used to be more subconscious or not deliberate, not a deliberate decision to say, listen, I am going to build a lifestyle business because I want to live my life to the fullest. Whatever money I earn, I'm going to spend on myself. Or I'm going to build a business that I can stand the test of time almost and be passed on to other generations in future and go big. And that decision to me is something that you can't necessarily take when the business is 20 or 30 years old already. So what is the timing of that? When do I have to make this decision? You're talking about the missing middle, and the missing middle is now this, it's not a startup. It's not a newfound business, but it's something that maybe has a bit of legs. It's proven. It's just starting to grow. Foundation is laid and things are more or less in place now. But when do you have to make this decision so that it's a conscious decision and not something that just happens over time with the business?
I mean, I think that's an excellent question, Rudolf. And I, again, with a lot of these topics, there's no perfect answer, but there is an answer for you, you know, or the business, each business owner. And it's the answer they reach for themselves. And just let's go back to the difference between a startup and a scale-up. So I often, or we often, we talk about a scale-up journey having a number of phases. And we talk about surviving. Because when you start up a business, you just probably are going to focus on surviving today, this week, next week, this month, this quarter, this half year, this year. And when you look back after, when you say, gosh, we survived the year. So the first phase is surviving, where it's a scramble for revenue to pay costs and keep afloat. The next phase we move into, we call striving. And the striving phase is the phase where you've got a tested value proposition. So your value proposition has landed successfully with enough customers for you to call it a market. You've got a way of delivering that value proposition, whether it be a factory or a service offering or a skill base, whatever it might be, whatever industry and whatever your business is, you've got a way of delivering that value proposition. And thirdly, you have got the ability to deliver it at enough profit level to pay your way. So the jargon is wash your own face. You can support the business. Doesn't mean the business is throwing off good returns. Doesn't mean the business is doing well, but it means it's paying its way. You're not having to draw on capital or savings or reserves or, you know, the generosity of family members to keep you going. You can do it. The business does it itself. Very often, that is like 2 or 3 years. As a anecdotal, from my point of view, I can't reference it, but kind of gut feel. It's about when businesses get there, that's the sort of testing time whether they are self-supporting or not. Then we move from the strive, and that's hard work. That's when you're running, you're working day and night, you know, you're kind of doing everything yourself. And often that's where the next challenge comes in, because it's centered on the business owner, the founder, because the founder knows how to do everything. And that is part of the winning formula, but it's also part of the constraint, because I often say to business owners, your business gets stunted or stalls because you can only do as much as the founder can get their arms around. And if the founder can't get their arms around it, then it can't happen. So the business gets to a point and then it seems to get stuck and it bounces back, and it gets to a point and it gets stuck, and it's extraordinarily hard to break through there. But if you successfully break through there, and if you look at work done by a researcher called Ichak Adiz, he talks about it as being the go-go years, where things are frantic, you're chasing market share, you're growing, it's very exciting, and it is hugely energizing. But it is also, it's a bit like a teenager, you know, that are testing every single boundary, and they rail and they rebel against it, but you have to put in place guardrails. You have to put in place rules and procedures. And I'm the last person that likes that in business, because I'm at heart a kind of innovator, I think, big picture, but I recognize the need for it and those values. So that if that happens, you might go from striving to thriving. And thriving is now where the business is starting to have momentum, and it's running based on procedures, systems, processes, a way of operating, rather than around the personalities in the business, the people, the founder and the hand-picked people that surround them, who are vitally important, but it goes beyond that. And if you get through that thriving phase where now suddenly you're throwing off cash profits, you've got returns, maybe you can declare some dividends, you're building up retained income, and yes, maybe you can afford that new Land Cruiser or that, you know, that bit of travel or something. And that's when you have to guard against it as well, because now you want to start building up these reserves. And then if you do that successfully, you get to the phase that we call arriving. So we talk about surviving, striving, thriving, and arriving. And when you're arriving, that's when you are doing better than better than average returns. The business is growing. It's got an established marketplace. It's got a brand. You've got good leaders in place. There's good performance management, good controls, good governance. And you're starting to be looked at by others and say, how are they getting it right? How are they doing it? And that arriving phase is where multi-generational wealth is created, because that's when you're starting to create wealth that can be carried over beyond the founder and beyond that leadership team. And it is sustainable in a multi-generational way. And that's where, well, let's be blunt and say that's where real economic wealth is located. And we don't have to look far to see examples of those kind of companies in South Africa and other parts of the world. So when should they start thinking about it? Well, the moment they hear about it, they should start thinking about it. So even if it's on day one, but just acknowledge that where you are in that life cycle is going to influence what you can do. And my encouragement for business owners is once they get into that thriving space when they're in the surviving space or zone, make the tough calls about putting in place structure, procedure, as much as it feels like entrepreneurs hate that because they want the kind of freedom. And I'm a little bit like that myself, but I recognize the importance of it, and put that in place, because that may just see you through into the thriving space. And when you're in the thriving space, that's when you really need to be conscious about this. So I think start thinking about it on day one. Make sure it's part of your awareness and make the choices intentionally. I encourage private owners to have independent input to their thinking as early as possible. There's debate about whether you have an advisory board or a formal fiduciary board. And I don't think there's a perfect answer again. Private business owners often don't like the idea of independent directors because they feel they're being policed and watched. And I've been on both sides of that fence. I've been the independent and I've been the owner where I've had an independent. Choose your independent director well, and you are careful and you're clear on what governance means. It can make a world of difference to your business. And one of the best examples of that is Google. So when Brin and I forget now, when they founded Google and they needed capital for growth, they went to the big venture capital providers in Silicon Valley and Golden Gate, or I forget who it was now. They said to them, we'll give you $1 million, but you have to appoint this person as the CEO. And they appointed that guy, Schmidt, who was born in South Africa, but grew up in the States. And if you read the book, this Google story, Sergey Brin, they say that if that had not happened, Google would not have made it, because they needed that independent insight, that independent input to help them navigate those growth years in a sensible way. So I kind of say, if you want proof that it is useful, maybe that's good proof. So come back to, I'm going to just, let me finish that, Rudolf. To come back to it, the scale-up choice is the first step in a journey, because the next step in the journey is a program that we call Building of Giants, rooted in values and purpose. And that's a 12-month program that we're offering to entrepreneurs online, whereby they will be able to participate in a monthly class, a monthly master panel conversation, have access to a community and forum, and they will be able to up their game to help them navigate that journey of surviving, striving, thriving, and arriving. And we want these giants to be in the arriving phase so that they can reinvest into the economy and ensure multi-generational wealth for their business and their shareholders and families. That's it.
Yeah. Very good. So it's not just the workshop or the conference on the day, but actually a program as well. And I think a lot of how the world has changed is that you don't just do online anymore. You're now binding into this community of like-minded individuals. And I think that little bit of a sounding board to know that you are not alone, that we're all going through this process, but also to have the expert in the room saying, listen, I hear what you are going through, and these are the things that we have dealt with in the past. It makes a lot of sense.
And Rudolf, you just give me a perfect introduction to some of the points that we see as being so important. So if I can jump in again, would you mind, with some thinking?
No problem.
So at Scale-Up Partners, we have a number of brand promises that we have centered our thinking on. The first one is, you will never be alone. That's our brand promise. So if you are if you're a private business owner and you're out there like pounding the pavements, knocking on doors, producing your stuff at night. One of my best friends who actually is attending on that day, when he started his business 23 years ago, I mean, the story is sorry, I've just got reminders popping up here. I'm just closing them down. When he started his business 23 or 24 years ago, he came and had coffee with me, and he like spoke it through. And I won't tell the entire story now, but he phoned me the next day and he said to me, Keith, if I need a place to stay in 3 months, can I come and stay with you? And I said to him, of course, but why? He said, I just resigned. And he resigned his job and he started his business that week. He's 24 years down the line, and every 5 years we go through this conversation of what's he going to do with his business. And every 5 years he intentionally says, Keith, my business is big enough. I don't want it to be bigger. So he's made a conscious choice to contain the size of his business. He lives a very good life. He's building good asset base, and he's made his call, but intentionally in that way. And, you know, I think of that journey. And it reminds me of our brand promise. So you will never be alone. So when we work with somebody, they'll never be alone. We won't always agree with them. We won't always have the perfect answer, but they will never have to process it alone. It's our first brand promise. The second brand promise is that we will always attempt to give you objective input. again, our input may not be the input that you hope to get, but it's going to be as objective as we can make it, and we will substantiate it. The third brand promise is that we will be in your corner when you have to make tough calls. Like if you have to fire a client who's not doing good for you, if you have to maybe right-size your business and go through a bit of a retrenchment process, because that happens too, if you have to make a tough call to put up your prices, if you have to negotiate hard with a supplier who's not coming to the party, those tough calls, we will be with you. We will have your back, we say. We'll have your back in the tough times. And then our final brand promise is to say, we will be practice informed by science. We will always do our best to find the real research, the hardcore research that backs up our thinking. We will resist saying, oh, it's a good idea and everybody does it. So those are our brand promises. And we are also so grateful. We've been in many ways blessed at this early day of this stage of this journey, because a person who's taken a great interest in what we're doing is Dirk van der Walt, who's one of the founders of We Buy Cars. And if you want to understand an entrepreneurial success story, that is a great, great example. And Dirk is one of the speakers on the day. Dirk is going to join us on the day, and he's going to share from his heart. He shares from his heart. He's him and his brother, Fawn, are just like two down-to-earth Pretoria boys who have done exceptionally well and observed many of these principles. And it's our homegrown South African success story. And Dirk is going to share some of his lessons on that day. So we feel very lucky. We feel very blessed to have a person with that experience be able to talk about how it's lived for him.
Yeah, I think it's an inspirational story and something to aspire to as well, in that we all see them on the billboards. And I remember years ago, just came to Pretoria after varsity, and I saw a billboard with the two brothers with some cash in their one hand. They're close to Botha Avenue in Pretoria. I thought to myself, I wonder what they do. And then nowadays you see the brand everywhere, and the expansion and the growth is truly something unique almost nowadays, with the speed at what it happened. I see the time's catching us up a bit here.
I get carried away.
No. It's been very interesting and informative as well. I wanna close off with this last question of mine. I've been in a very big business up until 2022. I ran a large business with 400 staff, 600 million rand turnover, and I just came to a point where I said, listen, this is not for me. It doesn't work for the way that I want to live my life. So I climbed out there and started my own business again, and much smaller now, and it suits me. But what I want to ask specifically is, what is your take on the role that company culture, the company's culture? And I know the culture is from the top down, but what is the importance of company culture in this type of decision that we have to make to say, listen, I'm building a lifestyle business, I've 30 staff anyways, and now I'm probably extracting most of the profits into my own personal life, building lifestyle assets, as you call it, versus on the other side, building a business for growth. And I assume there must be some sort of an impact or a difference in company culture. How important is building the company culture in there to make that business still successful?
I just want to look up something here, because I don't want to get it wrong. So you probably know the saying that culture eats strategy for breakfast. And it's attributed to Peter Drucker. And I think culture is one of the essential components of building a successful business. And culture, well, it kind of starts at the top. And people mimic their leaders, so they will copy their leaders. So and culture happens whether you want it or not. So, you know, whether you are mindful or intentional or thoughtful about it, it doesn't matter. Culture doesn't care. Culture will develop. So it's quite valuable to be kind of clear on the culture that you would like and that you would, that you want in your business. So it's essential and it's happening whether you know it or not. So I served on the board of a company for 10 years where we exited the business. We grew, it grew tenfold. It was one of the most rewarding periods of my working life. I worked with the three founders who happened to be three women. So it was a woman-owned business, which brings a very kind of unique dimension as well. And they, a couple of them had like deep psychology backgrounds. So they worked very hard on an intentional culture that they wanted. And it showed. And it shows today. The company is still very successful. They've had a couple of unsolicited offers to buy them. They've walked away from three offers that I know of. Oh, and that's the value of having an independent people on your board, is the first offer they had was very enticing, very seductive, and they were very drawn to it. And myself and the other independent director on the board, we unpacked it and we showed them that, in fact, they were giving up their shares for no increase in value or no true value realization for them. It wasn't a good deal at all. And they actually walked away from it. And I know that there's two more that they've walked away since then. So it's a very proud time of my life. And the power of that culture is what has seen them in a very competitive market grow 10 times in 10 years, tenfold. So that was amazing. The power of culture, absolutely. That's the first thing. The second thing is it's happening whether you know it or not. So the third thing is be intentional about it and build the culture that you want, and that will be good for your business.
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Keith. I appreciate that. I think for this discussion that would suffice. I think the conference itself is something that I'm looking forward to, and I think it's going to be something that gives value to people that have their own businesses, but also that have not really thought about this specific decision yet and actually didn't realize that there is a decision to be made. And I think that is the important part here, is that if we are in the room, you at least get one or two things to go and ponder about, to go and think about afterwards and say, listen, I need to go and decide where this thing is going, because we're all steering the ship, but have I really decided what I want to achieve with money is one thing, but in the end, it's your desire and what you want to really leave behind. And yes, we want to look after our families and so on. Do we also do that through the business, or is it just on the exit of the business that we do that? And yeah, as you said, a lot of us, especially that baby boomers, are getting out of business now. And if it's a lifestyle business, there's not much to get out of, unfortunately. So it's important that we don't make the same type of mistakes through the lack of knowledge. And I think that is what I'm looking forward to hearing on the day. We will also post the links and the enrollments and some information about it as part of the podcast. But I do appreciate your time. And I think as people can hear, there's a lot of knowledge in that head of yours that is not going to be able to be captured on a quick podcast or in the 2 hours of the morning of the 15th of April. But yeah, I do appreciate that you took the effort and time out to chat to us today.
Rudolf, it's an absolute pleasure. This is a topic very close to my heart, so it's a delight for me. And would you allow me to close with a couple of just points that have surfaced for me?
Yes.
So you said that people must make the decision, they must learn they have this decision to make. I kind of like to rephrase that just a little bit and say they are making the decision whether they know it or not. And what we want to do is help people be intentional about that decision, because neither choice is wrong or bad, just needs to be done with an open eye. And I'm going to then also share a little bit of our why. Simon Sinek, who's a well-known leadership presenter and author and speaker, talks about start with your why. And we've pondered that, and our why is the following. We have a big, hairy, audacious goal of impacting the lives of 1,000 businesses in sub-Saharan Africa in the next 10 years. And how does that translate? That translates into the following why. If I just add up a handful of existing clients we're working with, I can add up about 200 to 250 people that are employed in those businesses. And if we can improve each one of those businesses just 10% or 15%, then we are positively impacting the dignity, the hope, and the future of 250 families. And each of those families have probably got five people that are dependent on them. So we're looking at, you know, 1,250 people. So we say, if we can, our big hairy audacious goal, the why behind it is to impact the dignity, hope, and future of 1 million people in the next 10 years. That's what we aim for. And my last comment is something to smile about. And it's about, you used the baby boomers. Now, I'm a baby boomer. I'm in that age group. And last night I was working at Gibbs with MBAs, and one of the young MBAs who's 29 years old. So he's a young MBA, let alone being just young, 29. And he was talking about new engineers in his business. And he said, I don't know how to deal with this younger generation. And he was talking about an engineer who's 22 and he's 29. I burst out laughing. And I thought, I've never heard a 29-year-old talk about the younger generation. But I guess there's a lesson in that for us, is that we all have a place from 20 years old to 80 years old, and let's draw on each other's value in this journey. So that was something to make me smile. Hopefully it'll make you smile as well. Thanks again.
I realize nowadays that I do that as well, and that people out of school starts calling me Oom, and I take offense to it, but I probably need to get used to it as well. Thanks for your time. I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to the conference and looking forward to shake your hand and just see you there. And I hope that all your room of 200 now gets filled and that there's a great impact and a great turn up for the day. Good luck.
Thank you so much, Rudolf. Thank you for the time. Have a wonderful long weekend. And if we don't speak before that, we'll see you on the 15th.
Perfect. Thank you.